everyone hear me? My name's Diana, and I'm an alcoholic. This is a big crowd, isn't it? It looks different sitting down there than it does standing up here. I really want to thank you for inviting me to come and speak to your group. I consider it a true honor. I am very grateful to be sober anywhere, but particularly being asked to stand up in front of people that are also on the same path and be asked to share my story. I just consider it an honor and a privilege. But it never fails to make me very nervous. But we're going to have some fun. That's what sobriety should be, and I hear the laughter in this room, and it's very comforting. I'll tell you, I guess, a little bit about what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. So my first drink, I don't really remember. I didn't know it was going to be a historic event. I would have written it down because I take a lot of notes. But I didn't know the significance it was going to have in my life. I do remember I had six brothers and sisters. I grew up in the military. My dad was a career Army. But we were at a wedding. We were quite young. My sister and I had matching little dresses and coats and shoes. We're at this little wedding. Her and I were 15 months apart, very close, and still are. But we, they have the champagne toast. We were probably 5 and 6, somewhere around there. So they have the champagne toast, and then everybody gets up to dance. And there was a lot of champagne left in the glasses. And I said, let's try it, So she did, and we did, and we're, sipping on these, and I'm going, this is great. And she goes, I don't like it. And, my mind, I always have two thoughts going on, and I thought, how can that be? How can she not like it? It's delicious. It's excellent. I feel great. How can she not like this? And, gee, that means there's more for me. She don't like it. I mean, yeah. There was a bunch of us kids. So an ice cream cone, I'd eat mine real fast and then go, please, could I have a bite of yours? Mine's all gone. I started young to be a little pig and to manipulate to get more of, anything. So my sister wasn't like that. My mom used to say, I can leave your sister in a room full of scissors and razor blades and she'll be all right, but I can't leave you in that room. No, because I'm going to try them all. I'm going to experiment. Scissors, and you say, don't touch that. Oh, I'm touching that. Soon as you turn your back, I'm touching that. And then I'm going to try to get my sister to touch it, too, because I don't want to get in trouble by myself. I want a partner in this crime. I liked having a partner in crime. So my poor sister, we laugh today, I love her dearly. I have three sisters, and I had three brothers. So we grew up, we had a lot of fun collectively, and some chaos, of course. The first time that I actually got drunk, I think it was Blair told my story last night. I was at a friend's house. We had moved to Florida down in St. Cloud. It was 1978, I think. There was a big blizzard up north. Yay, we're in Florida. And I met this girl from, they were from Long Island, her family, and they'd moved down, and they had a bar and in the house, And we did that. We took all the different stuff and mixed it all together and went in the bedroom and drank it. Came back out and got another one. That's about all I remember. And then still I was in the shower, and her mother was slapping me, and I threw up everywhere. And the next day, I was quite sick, and I didn't show up where I was supposed to show up the night before, and my mother was quite upset with me and my sister. And I said, I'm never going to do that again. I am so sorry. I don't know what happened. This was a terrible mistake, and I'm never going to do that again. And I meant it. I meant it that time, and I meant it every time I said it after that. And I said it a lot. I meant it. And I tried everything. I tried everything to stop drinking. Not in the beginning. In the beginning, I was having fun. You know, there was some fun. I was a barroom drinker. I liked the bar stool. I felt comfortable there. I felt at ease on the bar stool. I did not feel at ease at home in my own bed with my own family. I didn't feel at ease. But I'd go heading for that bar room, and before that liquor even got into my hand, I felt better. You know, the relief. The relief is on the way. I couldn't get off of the bar stool, though. And that I did not understand. You know, there were times when I wanted to get off the bar stool, lots of times, and I couldn't. And so into those years, you know, my sister, my little sister that I adored, was getting married, and I was to be the maid of honor. And I couldn't get, you know, you're supposed to meet over at, well, Ron will know this, Rogers in Fitchburg, the bridal gown shop. You know, we were supposed to meet over there and pick out the gowns. And I was the maid of honor. It's a place of authority and importance. And I couldn't get off this bar stool. And they were calling the bar looking for me. And I was saying, tell them I'm not here. My sister that I adored, and my Fino, and I felt terrible the next day. But I couldn't get off that stool. The next day I felt terrible. Oh, how will I ever make it up to her? That was and you know what that's like. This is a repetitive theme in our stories, right? This is what happens. I didn't understand what was happening. I just related to the fact that I must be an awful person. I'm a terrible person. I can't do a thing right. By that time, my life had become quite small. I graduated from high school and I was able to secure a nice little scholarship at a local community college. And through the first semester, I was riding in with a couple of guys from my town. They were going to a different school, but it was right down the street, so we could ride together. And then I noticed Allen's Pub on the way to the college. Allen's Pub, that sounds fun. And I don't have a class till 11 o'clock, so guy, drop me off, and then I'll meet you at the school, you know, and they would come up to get me, and you know, I never left Allen's Pub again. You know, I tried, and I knew I should, and I had a class, and they were coming, and then the guys come down to the pub to pick me up. Do you want to ride home? You know, you're 20 miles from home. And I'll be all right. I'm okay. You know, 'cause nothing mattered anymore. You know, once I got to the bar stool at Allen's Pub, everything changed. All my plans, my goals, my aspirations, my responsibilities, all gone. I felt great. I felt great. Till the next day. So unfortunately, you know, that scholarship, I didn't complete the first semester. And even one of the teachers called me, one of the professors, and said, you know, just come in and take the final. I want to give you a grade. I said, okay, I will. You know how we do that. Not happening. You know, yes, 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 yes. Mm-mm. I didn't go there. You know, it's a shame, but that's what happens to us. So my life became very small. I was waiting on tables. I was a waitress, so you know, cash in the pockets every day, and I was drinking in the evening, and I found that there was a restaurant I could work in and a bar I could drink in right next door to each other. I had an apartment across the street. I don't think I need this car thing anymore. There's some responsibility attached to that I'm just not into that. Insurance and gasoline and who cares. So I could walk everywhere. There was a Cumberland Farms. I do all my shopping. I don't need this car. Too much trouble. You know, so I drove it off into the woods, took the plates off of it, left it there. I'm not doing it. It's too much trouble, that thing, always wanting gas and stuff. Huh. I just left it there. I had nothing that was associated with a monthly bill. If it's had monthly bill, I said, no, not doing that. A one-time fee, maybe, but a monthly bill, no. So the car was left in the woods. I don't know whatever happened to it. They might still be looking for me. I don't know. So I was walking, you know, and I go to the Cumberland Farms. I got to the point where I didn't even want to go in there and shop. So I make a list. I go to the guy at the counter. I give him the list. I go out, smoke a couple cigarettes, go back in. He'd have it all bagged up and ready to go. If they didn't have it at Cumberland Farms, I didn't have any. I couldn't deal with the big. The only time I went to the big grocery store. Now this is gonna, I'm a little older than some people. There was a Demoulas grocery stores, and you could write checks back then. And you got about 3 days to rescue yourself from that before the cops come after you. So, of course, I did that all the time. I thought everybody did. But that was the only time I went into the grocery store, because that's where you could write a check on a Sunday, get some cash, you know. Forget it now. You can't get away with it. They check your balance right on the spot. I don't even try it. It's a crime. I found out it's a crime. How can it be a crime on Sunday? I'm just trying to... The bank is closed. I didn't consider it a crime at all. I was going to get some money in there by Wednesday when this check hit. That's the only thing. And I'd go in the grocery store and I'd see people standing, looking. Look at all these mayonnaise selections. All these cereals, and I'd go, wow, man, that's way too much. I can't. Oh, no. You know, give me one choice. I don't even want to know. You know, there's got to be one brand, because I can't. You know, and now, today, I'm in the store going, wow, reading all the labels, and 4 hours later. And how did this happen to me? But, yeah, everything was a big challenge. So I was in the bar, and my friends were Eddie and Louie. They were the only friends I had anymore. And they were two fairly older gentlemen who I sat in the bar room, neighborhood bar room. I didn't go to the fancy nightclubs, not my thing. I was in the neighborhood bar room with the old guys and smoking cigars, drinking, 10 o'clock in the morning, and watching reruns of Hogan's Heroes. And what's the one with the letters that you'd spin? I forget now. The word, Wheel of Fortune, Vanna White. I thought I was getting an ample education watching those programs with Eddie and Louie. We would philosophize about everything that was wrong with the planet. They would, you know, and drink. And Eddie would need help off the stool once in a while, help him to walk over to the men's room. And Louie had a beagle out in the car. I'd go give it a Slim Jim every once in a while. And I was happy. Everything was good. I didn't like leaving there, in fact. I didn't want to stay right there on that stool. I was comfortable, safe. But unfortunately, they don't pay you to do that. And I didn't have a lot of money and a lot of prospects. And I was trying to work. At this point, I had been, you know, fired from some jobs. And so this guy that I had met, why do we do this to ourselves? Bad situation, make it worse. So this guy that I met had a job. I said, oh. And a company car. I said, even better. I said, Eddie, Louie, what do you think of this guy? He really likes me, wants to go out. Go with him. I mean, Eddie and I got all these sisters. I got a mother and father at home. Brothers, I should have, you know, I'm not asking them. They would have probably given me a bit better advice, but I wasn't. And, you know, by that time, they didn't really want to hear from from me too often either. So, Eddie, Louie, what do you think? Go with them. You know, you don't have, you know, yeah, good idea. So I did, and we ended up getting married. And I said, Eddie, Louie, he wants to get married. Go for it. You know, okay. So the saddest moment for me during those years really was one day that I don't know if Eddie came out of the blackout or what happened there, but he was looking at me like he'd never seen me before. And then he said, what are you doing here with us? He said, you have your whole life in front of you, sitting here with us, day in, day out, drinking. You know, you're young. And I was devastated. Devastated. Because I didn't belong anywhere else. I knew that. That was the only place I felt okay. And he's questioning me. So, so on it went. And the thing that I always had answers for everybody. You just ask me, I'll make something up. I could tell everybody what to do, but when things like that happened to me in those moments, I had no words. I don't know why I'm here with you. I remember a guy asking me one time, a little bit later, ended up marrying this guy, ended up having a wonderful child from that union. And we went actually to live in Denmark. So I went to live in Denmark for some time. And I said, good, oh, I won't drink over there. but, you know, their primary industry is beer brewing. So I said, well, I don't like beer that much. Because, you know, you got to drink so much of it. But I got over there and they had all this 80-proof beer. I said, wow, that might be worth a try. So I spent, I don't know how, you know, months, year over there drunk and going into the, and I'll meet people. I was going in the bar rooms over there, and now I'm drinking with the old guys. They don't even speak English. Eddie and Louie in Danish, right? And it didn't matter. I taught them how to cuss in English. They taught me how to cuss in Danish. I took them to see, believe it or not, I can't even believe I did this. I took them to see Scarface, to see how Americans live. This is what we do. Yeah. That's how we roll. I love them guys. So, not what it might have been. But anyways, so we come back to the States, and now I'm in this marriage that I don't know if I'm supposed to be or not, and I have this child. Now, things started to change, as they do, because now I had a child that I loved. I really did. I really wanted to do right. I was more invested in this than I'd been in anything to this point in my life. I knew what you're supposed to do. It had been done for me. Mothering. My mother was wonderful. I watched her with my brothers and sisters. I knew what I'm supposed to do. Now comes the horrors of alcoholism. Because I couldn't stop drinking. And, you know, I used to sit in the room and I'd hear women get up to the podium. And they'd say, I found out I was pregnant and I quit drinking for 9 months and I want a shooter. I want a shooter because I couldn't do that. That did not happen for me. Nothing stopped me from drinking. Not even pregnancy, nothing. Not till I came here. And it was many years before I could share that with anyone and then years more before I could share it at the podium and be honest with a group like you and say, you know what? I couldn't stop drinking, no matter what. And then having to walk through those feelings of shame about that and recognizing that this is alcoholism, this is a disease, and that's real. And so, and it make we do things that we don't do sober. You know, we do a lot of things, and that might be one of them for some of us. And I share it now because there might be somebody out there today still wrestling with that, not in their stomach, and not able to say it, not able to walk through it, not able to forgive themselves. It took me a long time to get there with that. It's very, very painful. But anyways, I'm still here. I didn't drink over it. And I had a wonderful son. I had a little boy that I adored. And I wanted to do right again, still and yet. And I couldn't get off the bar stool. And now I was really trying. Now I'm going, all right. Because I love the rum and Cokes. That was my thing. Rum and Cokes, love that. Make it rum and Pepsi. That'll do. That'll work. Take the straw out of it. Get that rid of that little straw. That's what's doing it to me. Let me do some cocaine. Then I'll be awake at least. Give me some of those pills. You know, after a while, I didn't care what they were. What are they? Oh, whatever. You know, give me three. It just didn't matter. Relief. Give me relief. I couldn't stand myself anymore. I really couldn't. Now this poor husband, God bless him, and I can't explain. And a guy sits next to me at the bar. I was waitressing in this one place that had a bar in the same building. That was convenient. Okay, crawl over there now. And he said, the owner, manager, whatever he was, he said, you know, you got a nice husband and a child at home. What are you doing here? Oh, God. How do you say, I don't know. I don't know. I didn't say that. I said, why is it any of your business? You know, of course. Challenge my drinking. I'll shoot you. Oh, don't think I won't. No, he's still alive today, I think. But I came close that night because that's all I had. But this was getting terrible. My family, I called my sister. She goes, you know, why don't you call me once in a while to say hello? Why is it always a crisis and you need $300 and you this and that? It was constant. And of course, the marriage disintegrated into, you know, terrible things. And so I thought, well, I'll leave this relationship and then I won't drink. That's what's making me drink like this. And, by then I'd been to therapy, the psychiatrist, all this stuff, and he diagnosed me with Valium deficiency, because I walked out of there with some great stuff. And you don't drink on that. Okay, I won't. Oh, my God, I was getting so sick. And then I'd come to, and I'd hear my baby crying, and I didn't know if he'd been crying for 10 minutes or 10 hours. I didn't know. And that's horrible. It's horrible. But that's where I was. And so I started, the psychiatrist said I might, want to go to treatment. The only treatment I'd ever heard of was on that Cuckoo's Nest movie where they, and I was like, I'm not going there, no. I never went to see him again. So then I'm alone. I got this child. I can't even keep a roof over our head. Now I'm getting fired from jobs because I smell so bad. 15 minutes that I spoke or that I need to speak more. 15 minutes to go. Okay. So, see, always two thoughts. Which way am I going? Give me some direction. I'll be all right. So there I was. Fired from jobs because I smelled so bad, getting evicted from apartments. First time that happens, you're like, oh, mortified. I'm getting evicted. This is terrible. You try to hide it from everybody. And then the second time it happens, you're like, oh, no big deal. Third time it happens, you're like, I got a routine now with this. I can, same thing with, all those horrible stuff that happens. The first time, it's horrible. The second time, it's like, eh. Third time, it's like, well, I got this, It's going to be all right. It's just unbelievable the lower levels that we go to and accept. We accept them because it's the price of our drinking, and we accept. I accepted that. I accepted that. I didn't know that I had a choice, so I accepted it because it was obvious to me that this is the way it is. I didn't know there was any way out of that. So then my thoughts were consumed with suicide because there was no way out of that. I couldn't look at myself in the mirror anymore. I looked in the mirror and I didn't recognize the person looking back at me. A shell of a person. And so I didn't want to live anymore. Too awful. This is so awful. And but I had this child that I loved. And I didn't know what would happen to him if I took my life. So I'd fantasize all the time about how to kill myself. And then I would think, you know, well, what's going to happen to him? And so I started looking for different jobs. I said, well, this waitressing thing isn't working. You have to smell a certain way. So, you know, and the first time that happens, I could buy, you know, come in the back room, you know, you really need to wash up. We can't have you serving food. You know, you kind of reek. And then you don't do any changing. So they, 3 days, you know, we give you a chance. Come on, you got to go. And so the first time that happened, I was mortified, embarrassed, you know, get to the bar room a little earlier because I don't have a job now. The second time it happened, I'm like, you know, these people don't know a good cologne. I'm not that bad. That's how you start to, you know, I was so saturated, my thought, you know, an atheist, I was an atheist. I would sit on the bar stool and argue the non-existence of God. I could prove it. So spiritually sick, physically sick, you know, mentally ill. Still am, though. So that doesn't quite ever seem to go away, but it was much worse. What happened? I went and I applied for this job, and I lied and lied and lied to get it. And I said, this will fix me. I'll work during the day when other people do. I'll bring a lunch. And I won't drink because it's the waitress thing that's making me drink. So I got this job in this office. This is back, a cable television had just come to central Massachusetts. So you can imagine the excitement. So I went to work in this office with about 7 other women. We're all in this one big room, and we all got a computer and a phone. And, of course, I lied to get the job, saying I knew all about computers and all about these phones. I had no idea. I hadn't had a phone in years. I'd never seen a computer. But I wanted that job. I felt I was justified telling those lies, just like all the other lies I told. I was justified. So I got in there, and I'm watching these other women, and I'm trying to copy what they're doing. I'm pretending, of course, and I know what I'm doing because I'm never going to ask for help. And I got the phone, and I'm pressing buttons, and I'm, thank you for calling. Call again. And drinking, oh, my God. And now I got to get up in the morning, and I'm sick, and it's hard to do that for me. I was not a functional alcoholic, and I despised functional alcoholics. They piss me off. How is it that they got up and went to work? How did they do it? I could not do that. Now I'm grateful because it brought me to my knees, I think, a little quicker, but because I wasn't functional. So anyways, I'm going to this job. I'm trying to be functional. And these ladies are doing stuff, and I'm trying to do stuff, and I'm going to the bathroom, throw up, go to lunch, don't come back, all that stuff. And one day the boss calls me into the back room. I said, well, you know, he's either going to make a pass, of course, or he's going to give me a raise, a promotion, and I'll accept it either way, whatever he wants. He's kind of cute. So, and of course, because my arrogance and my reality is not reality, my perception. So we go in the back room, and he goes, oh, yeah, see this big computer back here? And I said, I can handle that, no problem. And he said, no, this computer has been monitoring all the calls coming into this office. And you haven't been getting any. Who have you been talking to? And, you know, I used to get caught a lot, all the time. So I had a standard answer for that kind of thing, and I would say, let me just get my purse, and I'll leave, and I won't darken your doorstep again. And he said, I want to tell you something. And he proceeded to tell me his story. And he told me that he had been an alcoholic and a drug addict and a raging fool, and that he had 3 children that he couldn't visit unsupervised, that he was unemployable, unrespectable. But now, and I'm looking at him going, he's looking, and in 2 years, he goes, for 2 years, I haven't had a drink or a drug. I said, wow. I said, I'm glad that you shared that with me. No, you don't have to tell anybody else that ever again. I appreciate that you have confidence in my keeping that to myself. You take that to your grave. I promise you I won't tell anyone. And my mind's going, I got him. Oh, I don't have to come back from lunch. I don't have to really do my work. I got something on him. That's how my mind worked, automatic. I think he's asking my advice. I'm the Barstool psychiatrist. Of course he's seeking my advice. And then he said, do you know that you have 2 different shoes on today? I didn't know whether to look down and validate or say, these are in style, it's the 80s, I'll just get my purse. And he said, no. He goes, I want to teach you how to use that computer and that phone, and I want you to stay with us. And if you ever think that you have a problem with alcohol, I know some people. He never once said Alcoholics Anonymous. He just said he knew some people. He didn't say that I had a problem. He said if I ever thought I might. And he didn't throw me out. And that impressed me more than all the rest of it. He caught me dead to rights. I was used to that, and I was used to getting my bag and going on my way. And he didn't do that to me. That stayed with me. For the next several weeks while I drank and threw up and tried to get it together and made sure my shoes matched, and I became extremely paranoid. I had these armpit stains in these shirts I used to wear, and I used to go like this so nobody would notice them, and I don't have 50 cents to go to, Salvation Army where I shopped, and oh my God, the paranoia. So one day I was just tired, and the suicidal thoughts, and I'm not feeding my kid, and oh my God, the car, oh my God, and then I had a car again. I'm like, no. No, I don't want this. And now I got to hide it because they're going to repossess it. I don't even want it. So I went to him and I said, with the gift of desperation in my heart and the exhaustion, I was exhausted. And I said, take me to your people. I was tired. I was so tired. So, that's what happened to me. Here I come bouncing into AA. No, not bouncing. The first meeting, he wrote it down. He said, I can't bring you. I live in the other direction. 5 minutes left. He said, I can't bring you. I live in the other direction. Here's where it is. Go there. And just go there. Be there. Tell me about it tomorrow. So I went home. I had on my best Salvation Army dress, And I wore a disguise. I wore a big straw hat, big red bow in it, big glasses, sunglasses. 8 o'clock on a Tuesday night, I arrive. Alcoholics Anonymous, and a big meeting. There were 17 million people there, similar to this night here. And I went and sat way in the back next to, because I looked around, I said, these people don't drink. They got teeth. They got clothes. They don't know what I'm going through. But there was an old guy in the back with a big old drinking nose on him. You know the type. Storks pecked at it and stuff. You know he drank. I said, I'll sit next to him. He knows. He drinks. No one else here does. So I sat next to him, and my journey began. I didn't hear anything. I don't know what happened that night up here at the podium. But at the break, I saw a guy that I used to drink with at one of these bar rooms. And we used to fight over the stool, and he'd pass out on the floor. I'd climb over him, get the stool, you know. He was in there. Now, most of the guys that disappeared from the bar room, or women, they went to prison or they died. I mean, so I see him, and I go, is that who I think it is? So I go up to him after the meeting, and I said, hey, what's going on here? And he goes, who are you? And I said, it's me, Diana. He goes, we've been waiting for you. I got all paranoid again. I'm like, really? No, can't. No one's waiting for me, no. You know what he said to me? He goes, you never have to drink again. I said, what? He said, even if you want to, you never have to drink again. He said, come along with us. Come along with us. That's all. Just come. So I did. I had the gift of desperation. And through that, I was given the gift of sobriety. And that same person, over time, taught me how to he used to cherish his sobriety. He says, I cherish my sobriety. And I used to want to throw up. Like, this isn't all that it's cut out to be, okay? This is hard. This is not for the weak-hearted. This is tough stuff in here. You got to grow a backbone in here like you never had before. If anybody tells you this is easy, get away from them. Run for your very life, because your life depends on this. Mine does. So I stay away from those people that say it's easy. It's not. I was 3 months shy on my 23rd birthday at my first meeting. I was 22 years old, and I haven't left. I just stay. All kinds of stuff has happened to me. I went back to school. I became a registered nurse. That was something I'd always wanted to be. I had 3 years of sobriety. My sponsor helped me decide, what do I want to be when I grow up? I did that, and then about 10 years of that, and I said, I want to go to law school because they're suing our asses off out there in the medical field. So I did. I went to law school in Boston. I went, I went 3 nights a week to law school and 4 nights a week to AA. Worked all day. You know, you can do anything. They say bring your dreams here. I did. I was a sober mother to my child. That was my dream. That was all I really wanted, was to sleep through the night. When I first got here, I just wanted to sleep through the night. I had no aspirations beyond that. I just want to sleep through the night, and I want to pick my son up from daycare on time. You know, because I used to have to stop before I, and drink before I get to the... I didn't want to do that. It was embarrassing. I just wanted to sleep through the night and pick him up on time. And I have gotten so much more than that here. I moved to Florida a few years ago. I met Stan last year. I went to, I've been single and sober, okay, for a long time. And, you know, you come in here and you have to grow up. And I really had a lot of growing up to do. Last year, to my surprise, after I'd given up on love, I went to speak at a detox on Christmas Eve. The guy at the group, and I had just moved over there, the guy at the group was saying, we don't have a woman speaker on Christmas Eve. I said, you do now, the detox. I'm coming. So I went over there. I love that. And the male speaker happened to be Stan, who I had not met. And so after that night, of course, he was mesmerized by my charm. And wouldn't leave me alone. I'm going to the meetings. He's trying to sit next to me. I said, oh, another AA scoundrel, really? I'm not new to AA. I'm new to the area, but not new to the halls. And he was relentless, really. And he met my father, and he evidently impressed my dad, who was my roommate at the time. And my dad told me to go out with him. My dad. I said, really, Dad? He goes, what are you? Go with him. I had my first date after about 8 years with Stan, and now he can't get rid of me, though he does try. It's, you know, that's just not going to happen. We have fun. And so now I actually have that too. It's a miraculous thing for somebody like me. For hopeless, helpless, my life is incredible. I am employed, gainfully employed. I have fun at my job. I'm just going to leave one employer and go to another now. I was able to make an adult decision and make a change. And walking through that has been a challenge, but it's grown-up things and that we get to do. I haven't been fired for stinking too bad, and you know, since I got here. I'm grateful. My dad, my dad and I took care of my mom, and she passed away a couple years ago. And I inherited my dad. That's how I got him. And but we were taking care of my mom, and I said, "Dad, I'm so grateful for AA because I can be a daughter. I can take care of mom. I'm so grateful that I'm here." And he said, "Yeah, you would have been dead in the gutter a long time ago. You really would have." He lost 3 sisters to alcoholism, 2 on Skid Row, and 1 in a sanitarium. He's no stranger to this disease. So he's real happy that I found, that you found me, I found you, however it happened. Just stay. I don't say keep coming back, though you should if you leave, but just stay. Just stay. That's okay too. I'm very grateful again. It's an honor and pleasure. I'm going to try to not get hypnotized by my own voice, and I wish you all well, very well. Thank you.